This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In a few minutes, we're going to look at some food traditions and where the concept of three square meals a day came from. But first today, an update on Vermont Health Connect, the state's health insurance exchange. This week, the Shumlin administration has been explaining how a security lapse occurred in the exchange website, and it's also managing a few key milestones for the exchange as November comes to a close. Here to discuss those issues is Mark Larson, Commissioner of the Department of Vermont Health Access. Commissioner Larson, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
I understand you're traveling today. Thanks for taking a break from the road for a few moments to have a conversation with us. So first of all, the news of the week that everybody's been talking about, there was a security problem in October in which two people were able to use the state exchange with the same online username. And having the same username allowed one of them to get the social security number of the other. How was that a possibility, and why were duplicate names allowed in the first place?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I appreciate the chance to clarify it. So there are multiple security gates within Vermont Health Connect. And what ultimately happened is that the two users started off with different usernames. But then at a second security gate, the second user's username didn't work to get past the security gate, and they, in fact, had an opportunity to create a second one. And then when they created that second one, that's when the two usernames became merged. What we were able to do is to go back and make sure that this had not occurred for any other users to that point. This was October 17th, so it was about the first 2 weeks of Vermont Health Connect. And we were also able to make changes to ensure that the security gates required the same usernames so that it could not happen again to any other users.
So in other words, nobody can have a duplicate username in any part of the system now. You're confident about that?
I am confident of that, yes.
So when you were asked during a legislative committee hearing about security breaches, what were you thinking when you said there hadn't been any?
So my attempt to try to be responsive was focused on that one part of my thinking was that we had not had any external security breaches. We had this privacy incident, and I have not tried to parse words at all. I have acknowledged that it was my job to be mindful of all the different situations that might be responsive to the question. And I fully acknowledge that my failure to think about bringing up that case was a mistake that I have accepted. I've tried to take the responsibility for and have apologized to the committee and others involved.
You knew about that security issue. The governor knew about that security issue, so the administration was aware of it. Had there been any conversation within the group, within the administration, to try to keep that quiet?
No, it was not our intent to try to keep the incident quiet.
Why hadn't it been told in October, then, to the public?
And so we had followed our appropriate security, our appropriate privacy and security policies, which include a report to our federal partners. And at that point, the incident had been closed. And again, we had determined that it was a very isolated situation that hadn't happened prior and couldn't happen again.
So there was a determination that it wasn't something you wanted to tell the public at the time.
No,
you had disclosed it to the federal government, but...
We absolutely had. And I've tried to be clear since the weekend when I went back and reviewed the testimony. It should have come into my mind to include this topic in my testimony, and it was my mistake that I did not.
Commissioner Larson, yeah, go ahead. Did you want to say something else?
No, I'm not trying to make any more of it than that. Mm-hmm. This was my mistake.
Let's move on to other topics because there's a lot going on with the health exchange. Earlier this fall, the state pushed back the deadline for small businesses to enroll in the exchange, moving it from December 31st to the end of March. But in order to take advantage of that extended time frame, businesses had to notify their insurance carriers by Monday, 2 days ago, what they wanted to do. Does your office have a sense of how many businesses in Vermont have opted for the extension to stay with their current policies through the end of March?
We have been receiving information from Blue Cross and MVP about the responses that they received from their customers. We continue to try to compile that to have a clear list. What it indicates just generally, earlier the governor had provided additional options to be able to access Vermont Health Connect plans directly through a carrier and the option to extend your 2013 coverage as a small business if you wanted more time to make a decision. Generally, the responses seem to indicate that both of those options were taken advantage of by small businesses, and I don't have the final tallies about how many chose specific options yet. That information is still being put together, but it's quite clear that there were a number of employers who took advantage of both options.
Well, and there's the third option as well, right? If an employer did not extend the policy or move on to the health exchange, the insurance carrier would choose a policy that was most like what the employer had been using.
That's right. And generally, that seems to have been the most common option that has been chosen. So there are a lot of small businesses that have either elected or by not providing a response to the notice, will be automatically enrolled by their insurance carrier into the Vermont Health Connect plan that's most similar to the plan that they're in today. So that also was an option that was very common in the responses.
And it's hard to tell from that whether that was the intention of an employer just to have the insurance carrier move them on to the most similar plan or a lack of knowledge that the deadline was looming. Do you think there was enough communication with small business owners about this deadline extension?
I know that there was obviously a lot of public attention to the matter. I also know that Blue Cross MVP and associations, as well as navigators and brokers, did do quite a bit of outreach to small businesses. I think the priority for the governor had been to make sure that there were options available that ensured that those who have coverage in the small group market don't experience gaps in coverage unless they deliberately choose not to continue coverage. And so the goal was to make sure that Vermonters had a pathway to coverage. And I think in that context, the options that the governor has provided to small businesses have been successful.
And if an employer chose to not continue with coverage at all, then the individuals would move on to the exchange themselves.
That's correct, yes. That's correct.
Now, the back end of the Vermont Health Connect website, the online payment system, hasn't worked since the exchange launched. Can you confirm that the delay is related to security, making sure that credit card information will be secured when people buy their insurance online?
So what we really want to do is to make sure that we do the appropriate testing of the functionality that allows Vermonters to pay for their plan that they've selected and then be enrolled in the carrier of their choice before we make that functionality available to Vermonters. Obviously, we've experienced quite a few challenges and bumps in the road in the implementation, and in this case, we really want to maintain the integrity of our testing, and that does include making sure that security provisions and security testing is also a factor in our decision about when that functionality will be ready. Security is not the only component. We want to make sure that the whole end-to-end system is working before we make that live to Vermonters.
So there have been more problems than just security in making that a functional part of the website?
Yeah, I want to. Testing is really about practicing over and over again to make sure that when people were to use it in real life, that it would be ready to work without issue, or at least the risk of issues are understood and acceptable. So it's not that it's failing. It's that we have a number of different test scenarios that we need to see work effectively and consistently before we're willing to sign off that it's time for it to be deployed into the live version of Vermont Health Connect.
Well, the governor's goal is to have that go live on Monday, the first week of December. As we're heading into a big holiday weekend here, is it working? Do you think you'll have it live by Monday?
So we have a team. We have teams in the state of Vermont, as well as our partner in TGI, and working closely with Blue Cross and MVP and Delta Dental. We'll continue that work throughout the holiday weekend. We really are not expecting to take much of any break at all for the holiday. And we continue to assess on a daily basis where we're at with our progress in bringing that functionality on, and also assessing our options to make sure that the commitment that Vermonters who have coverage don't experience gaps in that coverage in January, again, unless they have chosen that directly.
That still doesn't leave me with a clear picture of whether or not on Monday that payment system will be online.
No, I understand. That's why for us it continues to be a daily assessment of where that's at and what our options are. We understand that there's a lot of pressure on us and our vendors because early December is approaching us, and we understand that pressure very, very clearly.
Is there a contingency plan, and what is it if it can't go live on Monday?
That's what I mean by we continue to assess our options for any possible scenario. We definitely are assessing those, and I have no specific information to share today about those, but it is very clear that we are making sure that we have plans available to ensure that Vermonters who have coverage and are looking to continue it do not experience a gap in that coverage.
Mark Larson is the commissioner of the Department of Health Access. Thanks for taking a few minutes to speak with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Speaking of which, coming up, a look at our mealtime traditions. Beyond Thanksgiving, there are some pretty interesting stories about how our meals have evolved over the years, from a big lunch to a big dinner, from an abundance of leftovers to a shunning of leftovers, and more. That's coming up next on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Now, I've been known to have a turkey sandwich for breakfast the day after Thanksgiving. Might sound a little strange when we have specific expectations of what is breakfast food and what decidedly isn't. But there was a time when breakfast was typically just a recycled version of last night's dinner, cold pork or mutton stew. We used to eat our biggest meal at lunch. Now the big American meal is typically dinner. And there was a time when snacking was considered lower class and unhygienic. Now it's practically an American pastime. Vermont writer Abigail Carroll has researched the history of the American meal in her new book. It's called Three Squares, and we thought it fitting on the eve of one of America's most celebrated meal traditions to have her on the program. Abby, what a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Let's start the show with a nod to Thanksgiving and what it actually tells us about ourselves as a culture. So take us through the sweep of time here and what the food on many of our tables actually represents about American culture.
Sure. Well, of course, the first quote-unquote Thanksgiving in 1621 was actually a harvest feast rather than an official religious holiday. Thanksgiving holidays were balanced with fasting days. And the, settlers of Massachusetts, what became known as Massachusetts, we know that they had venison and we know that they had fowl, and that may or may not have included turkey. So a lot of people might wonder, so how did turkey become the quintessential Thanksgiving food? Well, it was a New World food, but it also traveled overseas and became an exotic in England and a food of the nobility, on par with swans and peacocks. And so it was associated with Christmas. And when the Puritans came here, they were not for Christmas. They did not celebrate Christmas. In fact, they established laws in Massachusetts in the 1600s specifically against outlawing the celebration of Christmas. And they were willing to give up Christmas, but I don't think they were willing to give up turkey. Turkey, along with other Christmas foods like mince pie and plum pudding, were very typical in the 19th century.
And when we sit down to this big meal and we have all of that good stuff on the table or just off to the side of the table and we're filling up our plates, You know, you talk a little bit about how this does harken back to a part of American culture where there was one big meal. It wasn't a series of courses. And then we seem to have gotten away from that for a time when we decided, oh, we're going to be more upper class and debonair.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So in the colonial era, dinner was in the middle of the day. It was often the only hot meal. It was a large meal. And breakfast and supper were often just recycled leftovers from that meal. It was cooked on a hearth. It was often a one-pot meal. In the 1700s, the ideal became a kind of pudding and a roast. There was more meat, there was more prosperity, and there was more celebration of what it meant to be English. Because, of course, before the Revolution, colonists identified strongly with England. But in the 19th century, that ideal changed to become a French-inspired meal, a sequence of courses, much fancier foods, much more sort of delicate and refined foods, and the kind of meal you would really need servants to help you out with. And, you know, for the most part, middle-class Americans had the benefits of a servant or two at their disposal. And so, there was a Frenchification of Thanksgiving, a fancification of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And there was a backlash against that and a reminder of really the virtues of simplicity and of simple foods, which became particularly important when American middle class people could no longer afford servants. And in the early 20th century, you have a depression and two world wars, and so there's a lot of demand to be frugal and a lot of emphasis on homegrown, on home canned, on local food. In some ways, Thanksgiving was the first local foods movement. And so actually eating the more simplistic foods of Thanksgiving as opposed to the fancier French-inspired meal was very patriotic.
We're talking today about the history of many of our mealtime traditions with writer Abigail Carroll. Her new book is called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And listeners, we would love to hear how your meal traditions have evolved or what you've heard from your grandparents about how the ways they ate differed from the ways you eat. My grandmother, for example, always calls dinner supper, which confuses most of us. Let us know what's happening in your family or what questions you have about how we evolved to this point of three square meals a day. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Abby, we're getting several questions from people who have thoughts about breakfast and breakfast food.
Mm-hmm.
Simone in Stratford says, while I was studying abroad in Scotland, my Nana sent me some of her famous pancake mix. My flatmates thought it was hilarious that we eat pancakes for breakfast. Over there, it wasn't uncommon to see waffles with ice cream on the dessert menu in restaurants. And I always wondered at what point pancakes and waffles became breakfast fare for us and why it didn't catch on elsewhere. And then Andrea has a breakfast thought as well. She says, I actually prefer a dinner-type meal for breakfast, a fairly standard lunch, and then often just a bowl of veggies or salad for dinner. I haven't eaten cereal for breakfast in 45 years. I live by myself so I can indulge my preferences without bothering others. Anyone else prefer their large meal in the morning? So, Abby, can you take us through this idea of how we got from cold leftovers from dinner to cereal and very defined breakfast food?
Sure, yeah. Well, breakfast starts out, as I said, not as being a meal defined by its own food. And you often had leftovers from dinner or cornmeal mush. If you had had cornmeal mush for supper the previous evening, you might fry it up as Johnny cakes in the morning and pour some molasses over it, something like that. But as Americans began to prosper, the colonists began to prosper and become more stable, and they celebrated that prosperity with meat. And meat starts to show up on the breakfast table as really the centerpiece of it, and often even more than one kind of meat. And of course, near the coast, there was a lot of emphasis on fish and a lot of starches, including the griddle cakes that your first caller called in about. But griddle cakes actually come to us largely, the sort of pancakes and waffle tradition, from the Dutch. And they were actually not just more of an evening or a sort of a dinner type food, they were associated with holidays. So they would be a Christmas treat, they would be a Twelfth Night treat, or they were, you know, ways of using up butter and eggs in the days before Lent, a Mardi Gras indulgence. And it was really in the 19th century that they moved to the morning when there's such an emphasis on a big meal. And in fact, European travelers commented that in the 19th century, dinner really could not be told from breakfast because they were the same foods, except that wine was served at one and not at the other. So, yeah. And then we have a big change during the mid to late 19th century because of the Industrial Revolution. So Americans are leaving the city, leaving the country, moving toward the city, and embracing a somewhat more urban and sedentary lifestyle. And they can't sustain the kind of heavy farmers' breakfasts that they had been used to. And the country suffers from a rather national case of indigestion. They call it dyspepsia. And reformers such as Sylvester Graham and John Harvey Kellogg basically put forward the idea of a grain-based breakfast, a farinaceous breakfast, as something that is healthy and a much healthier alternative to the heavy, fatty, meat-based breakfast that Americans were used to. And we can thank these reformers, some of whom were running sanitariums, for breakfast cereal, because that's where breakfast cereal comes from. It was originally a health food.
So breakfast cereal really originated in the sanitarium in the United States?
It did. It did. People really glorified, these reformers glorified brown bread, which basically was whole wheat bread, a wheat that was unbolted. And they experimented with numerous ways of serving it because they served so much of it at these sanitariums that they were afraid of people just sort of getting sick of it and going to, you know, the next sanitarium where there might be a more interesting diet. Heads were experimenting, including later Charles C. Post, who goes himself through a sanitarium experience and then sets up his own sort of spa and eventually invents breakfast cereals himself.
Probably worth doubling back to mention as well, while we were talking about waffles and such, that in some parts of American culture, you know, chicken and waffles still is a dinner food, not necessarily a breakfast food.
Yes, it is. Yes.
We're talking today about the history of our meals, our mealtime traditions, how we got to this idea of breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and how defined they all are. And we're hearing from some of you about what questions you have about mealtimes and how they've evolved, and some of your traditions, some of you saying, look, I eat a dinner, recycled dinner for breakfast every day. So tell us what you do in your life and what questions you have about how we got here. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or share your mealtime questions with us on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're taking a look at how, what, and why we eat the way we do in America. Our guest is Winooski writer Abigail Carroll, whose new book is called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And we're taking your questions on the history of some American food traditions, as well as what you may have observed changing in your own family traditions through the generations. Give us a call with your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can always post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Abby, we got a note from Craig in Wilder who says, I have a theory that the idea of three meals a day has its origins in medieval monastic life. Monks' lives were governed by the hours of the day. This included when and what the monks ate. Did you come across anything like that in your research?
Well, I didn't focus on the European history of American meals or the sort of European origins, but actually there, this scholar is not the only one to theorize that there is monastic origins to our meal times.
We got a note from Dan in Hyde Park who wants to comment on my comment about dinner versus supper. Dan says, the confusion you had growing up is understandable and highlights the difference in generations. It should be noted that dinner simply refers to the largest meal of the day, be it during lunch or supper meal. What about this, Abby, the idea of supper? I mean, it's sort of disappeared from our lexicon today, except in some generations, at least.
Yeah, I find that some people use it very intentionally to mean a smaller, more snack-like meal at the end of a day after having had a larger dinner in the middle of the day, and other people use it interchangeably with dinner. But that confusion says a lot, and I think it's interesting because it's not new. In fact, when dinner first shifted to the evening in the mid-19th century, there was a lot of confusion. It didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen consistently. It happened in urban areas first. It happened among certain classes of people first. And so people, you know, didn't know whether to call, you know, the evening meal, supper or dinner, what to call the new meal in the middle of the day, whether to have two dinners, you know, one in the middle of the day, one in the evening. And in fact, etiquette manuals advised people to know their neighbors' habits, whether they were sort of midday dinner eaters or evening dinner eaters, before going and paying them, you know, a visit. So, yeah.
So for a while, there was a lot of variation in what people were doing in terms of when the biggest meal was. It sounds like it was a social conundrum.
Yeah, and intergenerationally, it posed a problem as well, because if you had two generations living in the same house, the older generation, you know, would naturally, you know, retain some of the older ways, whereas the new generation felt the pressures of the new landscape and the new, you know, working demands, and they, you know, would have changed more quickly to the more modern setup with dinner in the evening.
Let's go to Aaron, who's calling in from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about advertising. I was just wondering what do you think the effect of advertising is on all this? You know, because we all have the image of, you know, two big sunny side up eggs for breakfast with bacon, and that sounds an awful lot like a Denny's ad. So, you know, when did all that start to happen?
Aaron, thanks for the call. Abby?
That's a great question, and I'm really glad you brought up the bacon and eggs, because that itself comes out of an advertising campaign. So to continue the history of breakfast that I started earlier, we end up with this ideal sort of small grain-based cereal and toast, coffee, milk, orange juice type of an ideal in the early 20th century. But at the same time, the Beech Nut Packing Company was not moving enough of its bacon, and it wanted to sell more bacon. So it hired a publicist, and this publicist inquired with a doctor who basically was willing to say that it was healthier for people to eat a larger breakfast, you know, that this small, light, grain-based breakfast was really not cutting it. And so this publicist then found, I think, about 5,000 other doctors who were willing to agree with the initial doctor, and they invented the bacon and eggs tradition that came out of the 1920s that, you know, so many people associate with American breakfast today.
There are other ways, too, that advertising has really played a role in food. If we go back to this Thanksgiving tradition, you write a little bit and talk about green bean casserole and sweet potatoes with marshmallows. I mean, those sound like traditional foods to us now, and maybe we think of them as our parents' generation, but they're marketing.
Absolutely. You know, Americans have a tradition, at least since about the 1880s, of sweetening sweet potatoes or yams and, you know, doing so with molasses or brown sugar. We see that in the cookbooks. But in 1917, the Angelus Marshmallow Company decided that it would present to the American American cook the option of marshmallows instead of the traditional, you know, brown sugar or molasses. And they advertised that recipe, and, you know, it caught on. And like you said, we think of that as an American tradition, perhaps a somewhat regional tradition. You know, green bean casserole has a similar origin. It begins in a laboratory of the Campbell's Soup Company in 1955. And so processed foods have colonized our meals, certain meals more so than others. But I think that they've done so fairly ingeniously, and that is to turn foods that are perhaps seen as candy or snacks into ingredients in actual meals, and grafting those foods into traditional meals to create something new.
We're talking today about food traditions and mealtimes and how we got to where we are today with breakfast, lunch, and dinner food. We're going to talk a little bit about snacking, too, something that was really undignified for a time in American culture. Listeners, if you have questions, if you want to share your food and mealtime traditions, or just want to talk about what you think about this idea of three square meals and if we're getting away from it, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jason's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jason.
Good morning, or afternoon, I guess. I'm curious what your guest has learned about comfort food in American traditions and if there's a common thread of what we culturally think of as comfort food. I remember reading one time that for the Japanese, miso soup is comfort food, and so obviously comfort food isn't universal. What's the common thread in American cooking?
Jason, thanks for the call. Abigail Carroll?
That's a great question, and I didn't specifically look at what makes comfort food itself. And I think that that might vary a little bit regionally. I know that it varies by gender, that there are different ideas. I think that American women tend to prefer sweets as comfort food, whereas men have a tendency to sort of enjoy a home-cooked meal with certain types of foods, perhaps, you know, mashed potatoes, a lot of traditional hearty foods. And I think that that's interesting. But one of the things that I have learned is whether or not it's comfort food, a lot of American foods that we consider iconic are not necessarily cooked foods. When I think of comfort food, I often think of cooked food, but a lot of handheld foods have become comfort foods in the sense that, you know, you don't have to put a lot of work into them, and there's this immediate gratification, which I think is interesting.
While we're talking about comfort foods, let's talk about snack foods, because you've written quite a bit about snacking, and it has a pretty remarkable history. I mean, we do think of snacks as something that is pretty typical in the American diet today, whether it's healthy or not. You know, it could just be an apple in between lunch and dinner. But this idea of snacking has a sort of, a wide sweep through history. Can you trace it for us?
Sure. You know, in the colonial era, people didn't think twice about snacking. It was not an offense. It didn't mean a lot. People had to refuel, and they understood that. But in the Victorian era, when the modern meal really emerges, and this is when dinner shifts to the evening, what happens to dinner, it doesn't just shift to the evening. There's another change that happens. Dinner becomes a family ritual, and it becomes special. And this is important because during the Victorian era, people are suddenly going in different directions during the day. They're leaving the house, leaving the other family members. They're not working cooperatively on the farm or in an artisanal business in the way that they had been traditionally in the colonial era. And so the evening meal becomes special. And when the evening meal becomes special, snacking suddenly becomes taboo. It's an offense to the sacredness of dinner. It will spoil your appetite. And, you know, dinner had come to mean so many things. It had come to mean family bonding and family identity, but it also had come to mean, you know, middle-class propriety. It's where you put on your manners. It's where children were being trained up in how to navigate the ways of the middle class. And so snacking was an offense to all of that. But there were other reasons that snacking was looked down on. It was associated with the lower class because it was associated with places of lower class entertainment, vaudeville theaters, baseball parks, and other kinds of sports settings, fairs, political rallies. And it was often sold by peddlers. And these peddlers were frequently dirt poor immigrants who spoke broken English, and Americans didn't always trust their hygienic standards. Not to mention that, you know, these foods were not packaged. They were sold in the open air. You know, there were horses and carriages. There was manure dust in the street and in the air. And so, you know, anything that was sold open air was liable to contamination. So snacking had a lot against it.
Yes, and you talk about the vaudeville theaters and stuff. I mean, this phrase, the peanut gallery, comes from that era of when people would be eating peanuts in those kinds of places.
It does, yeah. The cheap upper balconies of the theaters where, you know, the patrons were just, you know, cracking open the nuts, and peanuts were always sold in nuts at this point. And the carpets were just, you know, littered with these shells.
So then how did we get from that to a time when, I mean, it started starting with peanuts and popcorn, but moving on to today where snacking is something that is totally socially acceptable, mm-hmm. or mostly socially mm-hmm. acceptable?
Well, the one word answer is commercialization. What happened starting with the makers of Cracker Jack in the 1890s is manufacturers of snack foods start packaging their snack foods. And when you package the snack food, suddenly it can be sold in a store and it doesn't have to be sold out of bulk and it can bypass the peddler. And so Cracker Jacks, you know, and other snack food manufacturers can advertise their snack foods as fresh, as pure, and really as fun. And I think the other thing is a lot of snack foods are associated with saloons. If you think about pretzels as well as peanuts, they were used to put an edge on thirst. Well, with Prohibition, there was a problem, you know, for these manufacturers of pretzels and peanuts and whatnot. And they had to find new creative ways to sell their products. So they, you know, for pretzel makers, they started making them in shapes of the alphabet and really targeting children and reframing this food as, you know, healthy and full of minerals and as fun and not as something that was associated with the saloon. And then eventually as ingredients. And then with the television, that's when, you know, you really see the snack food enter the home.
Yes, and now we can't seem to get away from that. We're getting comments from people on some earlier parts of the discussion. Lori Ann says Thanksgiving wouldn't be complete without the old family recipes made exactly the way our past generation made them, even though some, like the Pepto-Bismol pink Jell-O mold, aren't that desirable to our palates today. It just feels like it keeps the family in the holiday, thus comfort food. And BHA says sweet potatoes or yams need only a little butter, cinnamon, and nutmeg, no sugar, and certainly no marshmallows. So BHA not falling for that marketing trick. Now, you know, today, Abby, as we look at meals and mealtime, there's a lot of hand-wringing about dinner in particular, the family dinner, keeping that tradition, making sure everybody's sitting around the table, and worry about, you know, are we watching TV while we eat? Is the family scattered and eating not together? And what's that doing to the fabric of our community? And given that dinner tradition is not one that extends all the way back in our history, what do you think about this hand-wringing?
Well, I think that even if dinner is an invented tradition, it's not a biological necessity. Meals are not biological necessities. And the Europeans, you know, learned that right away when they encountered Native Americans in the 1600s, because the Native Americans more or less grazed. Even if it is an invented tradition, that doesn't mean that there isn't value. And I think that Americans are lamenting that decline. There is a decline in family meals. There has been since the 1950s. And my experience writing this book and talking to people and just simply saying, you know, I'm writing a book about the American meal and its history, you know, they begin spilling their guilt about not having family dinners without my inquiring at all to their personal eating habits. And I think that this is in some ways a call for a larger conversation. You know, we've been talking a lot about food in our society more than ever. We know much, you know, more, I think, about food, how to read, you know, ingredient labels. We know about, you know, the differences between organic and conventional, and we have the local foods movement. But I don't hear a lot of conversation happening about the value of the family meal and what is threatening it, what makes it hard to keep this tradition, and how we might move forward into the future and reinvent it.
But isn't there a sense, yeah, that we're always transitioning and changing, and so maybe this is just a transition to a new era?
Yeah, certainly. And I think that hands-off approach, if we continue in the direction that we're going in, you know, we'll see more and more of the blurring of snacking and meals. We'll see more and more colonization of our eating habits by processed food. And I think if we want to really embrace the family meal, we're going to have to sort of revise our approach to work, because work is a big part of what makes it hard to have family meals, having, you know, two adults working full time in a family and, you know, working more than full time often. And so I think that we're going to have to be intentional if we want to if we want to move this tradition into the future. And I think that there's reason to, because, you know, children who grow up eating family meals, they eat much more nutritionally and they take those nutritional habits with them into their young adult years. And they also do better in school. They score better on standardized tests. They're less likely to abuse drugs and alcohol or develop eating disorders. And so there's a lot of social benefits as well as health benefits to the family meal.
That's Abigail Carroll. Her new book is called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Thank you so much for joining us today, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thanks, Jane. Happy Thanksgiving.
As you've no doubt heard already, this year marks the auspicious conjunction of two holidays that both enjoy elaborate food traditions, Thanksgiving and Hanukkah. For many people, the traditional food of Hanukkah is the latke, a potato pancake. For a lesson in how to make latkes, we turn now to freelance food writer Melissa Passanen, who usually hosts a very large Hanukkah celebration.
There are a few holidays that we make a big deal about, and I joke that it's my Jewish guilt. So I overachieve when it comes specifically to Hanukkah. And so last year we had about 60 people, and I made, with the help of a friend, over 240 latkes. You start with 2 pounds of potatoes. The recipe calls to peel them. I learned a long time ago when I was doing pounds and pounds of them, there's really no need to peel them. Just make sure they're well washed. You're basically going to shred those in the modern way, not like my grandmother used to do it by hand. You shred those in the food processor. You take out half of those and you set them in a colander and sort of press them a little and let them drain. Then you chop one onion in the blade part of the food, you know, using the blade in the food processor. That one you do need to peel. You don't want all that papery stuff, obviously. And then you add half of the potatoes that you've shredded back in, and you pulse those relatively finely with the onion. Then you take that out and you pan mix it with the drained, still larger shreds of potato. This way you get a really good mix. You get the shreddy potato, but then you get more mushy, hold it together potato mixed in with the onion. And then into the big bowl, cracks an egg. A pinch of kosher salt and a couple tablespoons of matzo meal, although I've actually been using potato starch for the last few years because we have some gluten-free people who usually come to our party. So I'm pouring a couple tablespoons of oil into a medium heavy-bottomed pan, but we do want it to get pretty hot. You want the latkes to go in there and really sizzle. Hanukkah, for those of you who don't know, is actually a relatively minor holiday. I think a lot of people in the Jewish community would say that it's become a bigger holiday, partly because of its proximity to Christmas. But as you may know, is the Festival of Lights, and every night you light an additional candle on the menorah. And related to that in terms of food, the tradition is that you eat foods that are fried in oil. So it depends what part of the world you come from. Like, I've sort of always envied the Sephardic Jews who come from sort of the Middle East and Spain because they get donuts. But for the Ashkenazic, i.e. the Eastern European Jews, which is my heritage, you get to fry potatoes up in oil, and that's pretty good too. You definitely don't want to undercook them. There's nothing worse than raw potato bits. So, you know, they're not going to burn while you're watching them. So just cook them well is my suggestion. I always make my own homemade applesauce for the latkes. And in years where it does not bump up against Thanksgiving, sometimes I even will put some cranberries into the applesauce to give it color because it's, you know, often it's that time of year, even if it's not right on top. So I'll probably do that this year. But we're going to do Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving, and then we're going to do Hanukkah a couple nights later.
That's freelance food writer Melissa Passanen. Sage Van Wing produced that story. I love hearing about the food traditions you're sharing with us. Annie wrote in to say, I grew up in a rural area of southern Oregon where my grandparents had a farm. Breakfast was usually whatever was handy before going out to early chores. Lunch was a more substantial breakfast later in the morning, what some people call brunch now. Dinner was early to mid-afternoon after major chores and allowed for a rest period. Then late chores followed by a lighter meal, supper, in early evening. That changed when my grandparents sold their farm and all of the grandkids were in school. Our schedules radically changed, especially when Mom went to work. Breakfast became an abbreviated version of the heavier breakfast we had before. Lunch was packed fruit, sandwiches, cookies. Supper was our evening meal, now the largest meal of the day. Annie says, I still call the evening meal supper to honor my dad, who refused all his life to call it anything else, but it is my lightest meal. Once on my own, I went back to a meal schedule much like my childhood's, which in my 70s, I still keep. Share your food traditions with us on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Tomorrow on this program, we're actually going to make way for Turkey Confidential. Splendid Table host Lynn Rossetto Casper takes calls for turkey triage and recipe questions. That starts at 11. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a wonderful and safe Thanksgiving.